Hello there, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the M2.0 series of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Students Association's podcast. My name is Angela Frenzy, and I will be your host for today's episode. Our special guest for today is Christopher Edwards. Chris Edwards is a recently retired plastic and reconstructive surgeon and self-taught sculptor. He strongly believes that having an exposure to different fields through art and humanities is beneficial to medicine and surgery. While he was always interested in art and aesthetics, it was through a three-day drawing and modelling workshop called The Art of Reconstruction, run specifically for plastic surgeons, that he was able to discover this passion for creating figurative sculptures. There are various ways in which art and medicine interact, some clearly seen and others less obvious. Today we talked about his journey in discovering how art helped him as a plastic surgeon. He describes sculpting and modelling as challenging his thinking as a surgeon and showing him new perspectives, as well as giving him the freedom to experiment more. We had various discussions that I think are relevant to any level in the medical field, whether it's as a student or practicing professional. So without further ado, let's hear from Chris Edwards. I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we reside on, here in what is now known as Australia. The place of recording. I extend my respects to the elders of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present, and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that the sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and this land was and always will be Aboriginal land.
I'm only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
Hi, and welcome to our podcast series. We are so excited to have the opportunity to have a chat with you, and we're really glad you could make it. To start us off, could you introduce yourself and who you are?
I'm Christopher Edwards, a retired plastic and reconstructive surgeon, now full-time sculptor.
And had you always wanted to become a doctor?
No, I had always had an interest in what makes the body work. I was a little bit fascinated by surgery and even plastic surgery, but had absolutely no concept of what that involved. When I went to university, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I started a science degree. And my girlfriend, who's now my wife, was a nurse, and I went to visit her, but I had to go past a motor vehicle accident on the way. And then when I got there, she got called away to go to an operating theatre to deal with the motor vehicle accident. And I thought, I'd really like to do that. I'm really fascinated by that stuff. So I went back to uni and said, next year I'm going to start medicine. So away it went.
Yeah. So you started with science.
And that has led to medicine.
But what was the pathway from medical school to get into specifically plastics and reconstructive surgery?
Well, after graduating from medicine, I got a Bachelor of Medical Science and then the MBBS. Then you do an internship. I did that in Hobart. And during that time, I found I enjoyed the doing stuff more than the thinking stuff. And there was the option then to start streaming in either the surgical or the medical specialities. So I streamed in surgery. Did 2 years of the basic surgical training scheme also in Hobart. During that time, I managed to pass the primary, second go, and started advanced general surgery training. And from that, you need at least 1 year of general surgery training, at least you did in my time, to then apply to get into the plastic surgery training scheme. So I, in fact, did 2 years of the general surgery and then applied and luckily got in to the plastic surgery scheme. Up in Sydney. And it was a 4-year training scheme in Sydney then. So, and then I did, after I passed the fellowship, I then did an extra postgraduate post-fellowship year in Glasgow, Scotland. which had a lot of, was a very innovative unit. A lot of the more recent innovations, or more recent in my day, came out of the Canisburn unit there in Glasgow. So I did a year there and came back and set up private and public practice in Hobart.
Yeah. And something that we like to ask is, if your current career wasn't an option, what would you have chosen instead?
Well, it's a good question, in that it is something we'll probably be all fantasize about a little bit. If we had a chance, what else would you be instead of what you are? One of the things that's extremely frightening about a specialty is that you find towards the end of it that you're highly qualified, or you're highly specialized in something you're yet qualified to practice. So after all that medical training and all that surgical time in the hospitals, you get to the end of 4 years, or the middle of 4 years of your surgical training, and you've got to pass this horrible exam, and you think, I don't know if I can, and what do? People used to say, oh, you can be just a GP. Well, it's not just a GP. You've got to go and do GP training. And by the time you've done all the surgery, I'd be too frightened to do general practice, because general practice is a complicated specialty in its own right. So you are on the edge of a precipice a little bit. So anyway, having said that, my little fantasy job, I suppose, is I'm a bit of a frustrated architect, but I see myself at the pointy end of architecture. I don't see myself doing laminex benches and little houses. I see myself doing cliff-top concrete mansions for rock stars, or foyers for giant buildings and that sort of thing, which I guess is a bit of a fantasy.
Yeah, that's what our fantasy jobs tend to be, often very niche and highly specific, but super cool.
The other thing is, you know, we're talking about art and the arts, and people often, parents of their children often ask, my son or daughter is thinking of going on and being an artist or a musician or whatever. And the reality is, and that's a bit of a conundrum, that you're never going to be the top movie star, musician, artist, unless you give it 100%. But at the same time, what's the percentage of people who dabble in the arts who actually get to that point where they're even financially independent, let alone doing exceptionally well? We all fantasize about being a member of the Beatles or something, but there's not many people. So most people end up playing a few gigs or something on a Friday night, or painting the occasional picture. And at best, you can subsidize that with being an art teacher or a music teacher. So my advice generally is, from my own experience, get a profession that you enjoy. And although it doesn't sound too good to say that, you know, if you don't have to be brilliant to make a good career and a good living out of a profession, and that can then fund you to dabble in whatever art you want. And with my sculpture, I don't do things that people said, can you make me a bird bath, or can you do this or do that? I just do things I want to do. And if someone wants to buy it, that's fine. And I don't have to educate and feed my family.
I've heard of many artists who are limited in what they do because they might be very passionate and creative, but they still have to stick to the outlines of what they're commissioned to make. And that's kind of the difference between a hobby and a job. As with a hobby, you have much more freedom in what you do if you aren't focused on making a living out of it and all the financial stress of that.
That's right.
What you were saying, I was also thinking and wondering, was there ever a time when you were just starting out and you were doubting your ability to do something, or your ability to make sculptures, for example? And how did you get past that?
Well, I guess with medicine, I had numerous times when I wrestled with, I'm dyslexic, so you know, I was hopeless at school, and there are a number of things that got me through all of that. And I didn't find out I was dyslexic until I was in fifth year medicine. But old study was hard. If you can't read and spell, it makes life difficult.
Yeah.
So there were lots of times during my medical training and my specialty training where I'd just say, look, I'm over this. There's more to life than having to do all of this stuff. So I guess I got through it partly by not wanting to see myself or have other people see me as a failure, and because I really did want to get there. So anyway, I got through the medical thing. When it comes to the sculpture, there's another funny enigma about me in that I don't think, no matter how many times people say, oh, you're so talented doing those things, it's not talent, it's just pig-headedness, I think. If you want to do something enough, you just do it. And I'm not overly confident, and yet I do believe strongly that if I try hard enough, I'll do it. And there's a quote from Henry Ford that says, if you believe you can or you believe you can't, you'll be correct. In other words, if you believe you can, you'll be able to, and if you believe you can't, it won't work. And they say that dogmatic determination beats unfocused brilliance. That's basically it. If I decide I'm going to do something, it's like I decided I'm going to do an Ironman triathlon. Well, I figured if you just run slowly enough, far enough, then it'll happen. But it's not quite that simple. But, yeah, I did one, and it works. So I think it's self-belief, and it's strange when you're not confident to have self-belief, but I used to as a kid, and it's probably been of benefit to me in many ways to be ignorant. But as a kid, I believed that if you practiced enough, you could be the best in the world at anything.
Yeah, well, you could probably learn a few things from the self-confidence kids have.
Now, I know, no, that's not true, because you genetically can't be the world's fastest sprinter or marathon runner or anything unless you're genetically gifted. But believing that you can means that you can achieve an awful lot of stuff because you believe you can do it. So you just set aside the time. And that's how I felt about the sculpture. I thought, well, I can do that. Shouldn't be anything stopping. I actually really liked the first one I did. In retrospect, it's pretty naive. In some ways, I'm now a bit too particular. I can produce a figure that's pretty close to what the figure's supposed to look like. But in art, that's not necessarily a good piece of art because you're supposed to be able to capture the gesture or the meaning without too much detail. But that's another subject.
Yeah, there are so many different types of art forms. There's the abstract art and there's more realistic art. In your sculpting, what kind of form do you try to lean towards? Do you have a style?
I guess I'm shifting a little bit, but my style, certainly to begin with, was fairly realistic, figurative. It is also a little bit idealistic, realist, figurative. And what I tend to do is create male and female forms that are sort of pretty on the scale of the various canons of proportion, beautiful, correct structures. They're not like the everyday lived-in bodies of someone like Lucian Freud, who, if you look at his paintings, there's nothing particularly glamorous about many of his models. And for some in the art world, that's a criticism of my work. Oh, you're just creating fantasy things that's not real. But that's what I do. And I suppose in plastic surgery, although it's not possible, you're starting out with the aim, either in reconstruction or cosmesis, to create the ideal portion and form. And usually you fall short of that, but it's a decent aim. So I'm used to aiming that way. The other thing that I have found a little bit is the exactness of a surgical career over a lifetime has in some ways inhibited to fully embrace the freedom art gives you, because you can make someone with two heads or the head six times as big as the body. You can do all sorts of things, but being a bit older and being less fluid intelligent and more concrete intelligent and having all this exactness trained into me, I've overly focused and can be a bit too realistic. But that's at the moment, most of my stuff has got a realism to it. I've done some other sort of fantasy things of skulls in boxes, but even that, the skull is realistic. So I struggle a bit, and I would like to be a little bit more gesture and a little bit more rough and abstract than I am. But that's the next step in art, is to go from can I do it, try and get it right, get it right, get it right. I've got it right. Well, now you're at the beginning. Now you've got to unwind that a bit. And as you will probably appreciate, some of the attraction of a Rembrandt painting is not just the subject matter, but the brush strokes and the paint, and you can see it. Some of the super real paintings that are done now, they can be admired because they are so realistic, but you know, why don't you take a photograph?
So you were talking about painting before, but what you do is you do bronze casting, which I suppose isn't the most typical downtime hobby that someone could do in their spare time. So how did you get into that?
Well, I've always made things way back. I've made things out of necessity. As a kid, you know, there was no thought of being bought a number of things, and we could make things. And now they're so complicated, you can't make your own. But I've always made things. I've built furniture, I've built boats, I've built all sorts of things. So I've done things out of necessity and because I enjoy making things. And I did a lot of painting. I painted things to put on the walls, but they were usually copied from something I'd seen in a gallery or something that I'd seen in a magazine. So they weren't particularly original. And I was never trained as a painter. I'm not even really trained as a sculptor. Then our group had it was organized to run a course called The Art of Reconstruction, specifically for plastic surgeons, run by a drawing lecturer at the University of New South Wales, Michael Essen. And it was a two-day course, a group of about 10, 15 plastic surgeons, and he ran us through a series of drawing exercises and modeling with clay exercises and really introduced us to a totally new way of looking at form and angles and volumes. And I was struck by how all us amateurs did manage to create a likeness of one of the last exercise we did was to produce a likeness of the partner you're working with. And I was amazed that we all could create something in a short space of time with no real experience. And I thought, well, maybe I'll give this a go at home. And if I work long enough, weeks and weeks, because clay, it's great. It's additive. You can put it on. Oh, that's too much. You take it off, put it on, take it off. I'd never realized that I've never used clay before, and I'd never actually thought that there's reductive carving and additive carving or additive modeling. And, of course, reductive, when you're doing marble or you're doing woodwork, once you've taken it off, it's gone. And the same with plastic surgery. Once you've taken it off, it's gone. So I found that the ability to put it on, take it off, put it on, take it off until you've got it right was great. So that's what stimulated me to try sculpture. And also, it's three-dimensional. You rotate it, you work on it. You don't need to know anything much about perspective and all those things that you've got to learn if you want to be a good painter or drawer. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go. So I did, and I cast that piece in 2003. And it's an inordinately complicated and labour-intensive process to do, the lost wax process. And I don't know whether you've got time for me to run through the...
Well, I definitely would be interested in maybe a quick crash course overview on how you make your sculptures. You start modelling out of clay and then the finished result is bronze. So I'm assuming there's various steps to go through in between.
So maybe is there a short version of the process?
I'll try and make it short.
Okay.
You first of all need a steel or aluminium armature, a frame. You've got to make a stick man. That holds the clay, because if you try to build a figure out of clay, it falls down. So you need an armature. You make your figure or whatever it is you're making out of clay on the armature, and the armature will hold it, and you can have a support frame external to it to hold it. Once you've got your sculpture done, that is the art already. You've done it. You've created a form. Then if you want to cast it, you have to make a mold. So you paint that form with silicon rubber and you put multiple coats on until you've got about half a centimetre, 5 millimetres in thickness of silicon rubber over your figure. Often you have to cut the legs and the head off the figure first because it's difficult to mould a complicated figure. It's easier to mold a leg or an arm. So you've done the silicon. Then you've got to put plaster of Paris shells over the silicon because the silicon rubber without the clay in it, it'll fall down. So you need shells, and those shells have to be able to come apart. So you've got to make them in an artist's world. You've got to design them in a way that they don't, no undercuts, they can pull apart again, and you put little keys in them. So you put all that on in stages. And once you've got all of that done, then you crack it all open. Then you cut the silicon open and you get the clay out. And clay usually gets thrown away. It usually gets pretty severely damaged in that process, but you can preserve it. Then you clean the clay, wash the silicon out, and you put it all back together. Now it's hollow. Now for most sculptures before you actually put it together. You get hot wax, melted wax, and you paint it on the inside of the silicon till you've got it all covered, probably a couple of millimetres. Then you put it all together, hold it all together with tapes and various things. Then you pour more molten wax into it, shake it around, pour it out. That seals everything off. Then you open it all up again and you get the wax out. And then the wax has got seams and holes and problems, and you've got to stick the waxes together and fiddle with them. Then you have to add a feeding system called a sprue system, a big rod with lots of little feeders to allow the bronze into it, and a whole lot of exits from high spots to let the gases out. So that's called the runners that feeds the bronze, and the risers will let the gas out. You have a little pouring cup at the top. You have to fill the hollow Easter bunny type wax with a mixture of plaster and sand, and you have to have nails to go through it to hold that in place. And then you embed the whole thing, sprues, figure, everything, in a big plaster and sand block. So that becomes your secondary mold. Then you tip that upside down and you put it in a kiln at about 550 degrees and you leave it there for 48 hours and that burns all the wax out. You've got to burn every skerricut wax out. Take it out of the kiln, tip it back up. Then you can pour the bronze in, which is about 1,200 degrees. Once that cools down, you can then attack it with a sledgehammer so your secondary mold gets broken. It's only your primary mold that can allow you to do another wax. So then you've got this messy-looking piece of bronze with all these bronze rods running off it everywhere. You attack it with a water blaster or even a sand blaster and clean it up. You've got to get the core out from inside it. You have to cut all the system off with an angle grinder and grind it all down and then disguise where it was, try to put in the same brush strokes and that sort of thing, or thumbprints that you had, doing all that with burrs, weld the various bits together, disguise the welds, sandblast it again, then you can put your colour on. So that's when you heat the bronze up and you can put various chemicals on, which depending on the chemicals you use will turn it green or brown. So that's how you get the colour to the bronze. Cover that with wax and mount it. So it's a bit of a laborious process. And, of course, each step of the way, it's like it gets damaged. You do this perfect clay and the last little brush stroke, and then by the time it's been moulded and you've done a wax, there are all sorts of defects you've got to fix. So it's keep having to repair it.
Yeah. I've seen some of your sculptures and they seem so detailed. But as you just described the process, there's so many steps that go into making it to let it all out to the final sculpture. Did you ever draw any parallels between following the procedures of creating a hand out of bronze compared to reconstructing a hand in your surgical practice?
Probably not hands, because hand surgery is more the function of the hand rather than the look of the hand. So creating a hand in bronze or a clay that looks like a hand doesn't really help you much with hand surgery, except I did one where, as a technical exercise, I started by modelling the skeleton and then kept adding the bits on and then made an anatomical-looking hand. Most of the original part of the sculpture gets lost in the building up, but that was a good technical exercise. Where the sculpting has been far more beneficial is more in facial reconstruction. And that's one of the things Michael Essen demonstrated to us, is that all of us had a more of a two-dimensional view of a face because we've learned it in books that are flat. In traditional surgical teaching, they teach you to stand on the right side of the table and operate and don't wander around the room. He taught us that to get an impression of the angles and volumes and the spatial awareness, you do have to move around. If you're doing a breast reduction or a breast augmentation or breast reconstruction, there's no good just doing it all from one side. You've got to get down the end of the bed and look. Are they the same size? Are they sitting properly? That was a huge benefit. There are a lot of measurements that are accepted as being ideal for the human face, which cross-fertilize. It helped me a lot with my sculpture because I'd learned a lot of them, for example, doing rhinoplasties. And it dramatically helped my surgery because it taught me how to look at the various angles from different views. And it's often amazed me how a plastic surgeon can endeavor to reconstruct an ear or a nose and yet can't make one out of clay. And in making a piece of the human body out of flesh, which had to maintain a blood supply and has a natural healing propensity to shrink or to swell and all these different things. If you wanted to try and make a nose out of flesh with all those added difficulties, you really should go and try and make one out of clay first, because you'll learn an awful lot. If nothing else, you learn the volume. I learned a lot about how much clay you have to put into someone's hemi face to make a cheek. When we went to this course, the first thing he did was give us a nose or an ear or a lip or something to sculpt. And I did this nose, and I was pretty pleased with it. It looked just like a nose to me. Then he came around and had a look, and he said, classic, classic. I thought, oh, good, done a good job. He said, classic error made by surgeons. And he laid a tongue depressor on the bridge of the nose. And whereas the bridge of the nose on the model I was copying was perhaps 30, 40 degrees of projection, mine was probably 20 degrees. So, and then the people doing the lips had done them flat, whereas in actual fact, if you look at the dental arch, it's a horseshoe, it's a curve. So we all, fortunately, because the skeleton we've been working on has already got its three dimensions, we've been getting away with it. But you become a far better surgeon once you grasp some of these deficiencies in our training.
Yeah, and this was a course for plastic surgeons. Did you find that many of your colleagues also enjoyed artistic hobbies?
Yes, particularly plastic surgeons. There are a lot of very accomplished artistic people in medicine in general, musicians, artists, winemakers, you name it. There are lots of them throughout all of medicine. And I'm not aware of a lot of them. I'm becoming more aware of all the ones in plastic surgery, and there are lots of sculptors and painters within the plastic surgery speciality, which is logic. But the disappointing thing, I guess, is there were 250, well, there are probably a lot more now, 300, 400 plastic surgeons in Australia, and there were 15 of us attending. And the trouble is that the people that attend are the people that are already interested, and perhaps the people that need to attend are the ones that aren't interested that perhaps need the most tuition. It's the same with risk management meetings. They have, I think it's compulsory now. The medical defence people say you've got to attend some risk management meetings. But back in my day, the people that attended the risk management meetings were probably the least risky doctors. They were just trying to improve their practice, whereas the ones at the greatest risk couldn't be bothered. They didn't have a go.
Yeah.
But, yes, there are a lot of people. And an example, one of my colleagues here now works in Melbourne, Nicholas Pohl, the musician, and he started up the Doctor's Orchestra because he just found as he went around there were so many closet musicians within the medical profession that he started up quite a decent orchestra that I think they were meant to play this year, but the virus got in the way.
Something I've been wondering is, back when you did work full-time as a surgeon, how did you manage to find the time to balance your work, your hobbies, and anything else in your life?
I'm a great believer in if you want to do something badly enough, you will make the time. And I found in my case that has worked. We can all be a lot more efficient than we are. Colleagues of mine, when I was training, often didn't aspire for anything else in particular, so they'd spend all day at work, whereas I had things I wanted to do. I wanted to go down to Bondi and I wanted to go surfing, so I'd work flat out to go, and usually that worked, and everyone was amazed. But the last guy here is here till midnight, whereas you seem to be covering the same amount of work, and I think it's just motivation. An example of that is when I was at school and we were coming up to the first set of external examinations, and our geography teacher gave us a midterm exam, and all bar one or two of us failed. I think I got about 45%. He said, well, there you go. You guys are in trouble because you're going to go for this external exam. You know, I won't be there to help you. And we topped the state. Our class topped the state. I ended up with a credit or high distinction or something, way overshot where I thought I had to be, because it made me think I wasn't doing well enough. And a colleague of mine, who was also dyslexic, he struggled a bit getting through the medical course. He went on to become a psychiatrist. I've often used him as a bit of a role model for students who are having a bit of a battle. And I said, you know, you're working so hard all through the year to get through, you'll have a better base than the rest of us. And he went on to become a professor. And I was talking to him a few years back, and he said, oh, I used to tell the students that I only had a Holden brain, but I drove it like a Porsche, and then eventually it became a Porsche. And I think that is very true. I think that's very true. And the other thing with time, I have a very supportive wife who has dealt with a lot of peripheral stuff. She was my practice manager. She looked after children, looked after the home, and has really allowed me to work and then do all my various side things I want to do, which has helped me a lot. I think there is a risk in medicine and specialty medicine that you do work so hard that you then feel, when I'm not working, I deserve to do whatever I want. And we can become selfish, and I've become selfish, and I've got mates who are very selfish with their time, and it seems to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. The harder you work to provide for everybody, the more you are selfish with your time when you're not working. I think perhaps the young doctors and young surgeons I know are far more disciplined about the work-life balance than we are, and my predecessors were worse than me. They used to be, they'd proudly say, I haven't had a holiday for the last 5 years. Well, I wouldn't be proud of that myself now. And, you know, I've worked really hard. So I think you can do it. I get into trouble from both sides of the gender divide when I say I really admire the females who get through a speciality, because as much as everybody is anti-discrimination and everything, nature is discriminatory, unfortunately. And girls have a biological family clock in there that has to be meshed somehow with the specialty training, which is very difficult. So I don't know whether I would have managed to get through if I was trying to have a family at the same time. But I think if you want to do it badly enough, you'll do it. One of my mates is a highly successful neurosurgeon, high-end stuff, busy trauma, putting 3D printed things into your neck to replace your vertebrae when they've got cancer growing in it. And he's a world leader in that stuff. He also was borderline Olympics with sailing. And he'd disappear off all over the world to go sailing. Well, you know, how in the hell does he do that? But he did. So you can, if you really want to.
Yeah, I guess another thing is sometimes medicine is such a demanding both study and then also job later in life that, well, it has the potential to kind of take over your life and you just become medicine. And in university, we get taught a lot that it's important to have a life outside of medicine, but I guess they don't really teach us how. But you've taught yourself sculpting and this hobby has become a big part of your life. So what advice would you give to a student who maybe doesn't really know what they want to do as a hobby yet and how they could find one?
Well, certainly I couldn't do all of my hobbies and my various endeavors all of the time. I had, before I did medicine, I'd enjoyed drawing. I'd never really learnt to draw properly. If I go to a life drawing class, I'm a bit of a klutz. I can copy something. But anyway, that's another story. So I've always done a bit. And I used to decorate the walls of flats and houses and things with my own work, largely because we couldn't afford anything else. I used to build frames and things. So I had a little bit of a hobby, make things background. But when I went to Sydney, I didn't have workshop. Didn't have anything. So I did a couple of drawings, I think, and that's about all. So I just focused on my training. I did the surfing thing and the running thing. So I made time. I just made time. And most medical students do. They go away skiing and they go overseas for their holidays and electives and things. They do seem to find the time. Now, when I eventually got back into practice, my whole modus operandi and motivation was establishing a practice. So I did nothing except full on, I want to establish a successful practice. So I didn't do much. I built my own desk for my practice in my spare time because I wanted to. I wanted one of my motivations because I've got this aesthetic thing that I wanted a really nice office. So I built this Kilpin Pine desk. So I did that in the early stages. But for a while, it was just full on, I'm building a practice, and that was my focus. But once you get into the groove, then it just becomes a natural thing that, well, now I'm here, what else do I want to do? I wanted to learn how to windsurf. I wanted to take up skiing again. Things find you in a way. I had skied a little bit as a kid, came back as in practice. The first meeting of one of our societies that I could attend was in New Zealand, and they said, do you want to do a week before the actual academic meeting, go skiing? I thought, that's a good idea. I'll go skiing. Hadn't skied for 20 years. So I went and bought some skis, and all of a sudden I was obsessed with skiing then, so I wanted to go skiing here and there and everywhere. So I made time to go skiing. So I think you can do it. But I think it is very important. It becomes more important towards the end of your career too, I think, because I know a number of successful colleagues of mine who really get, they talk to me and they're worried that what will I do when I retire? I don't like the word retire. I think what retirement should be is that you transition out of one activity and you transition into another. I was doing both sculpture and plastic surgery for a long time, and then I got slowed down with plastic surgery and I revved up the sculpture, so I transitioned and I'm still physically capable, but I'd shot my bolt really with the plastic surgery. My heart wasn't in it anymore, and that's one of the errors I think I might have made in life because I was more aesthetically inclined than perhaps my colleagues here when I first moved down to Hobart. I started to take on more of the cosmetic work. So slowly I evolved from hand surgery, big time head and neck microsurgery, general plastic surgery, and I slowly evolved because it allowed me to escape. It allowed me to escape on call. It allowed me to escape getting called out in the middle of the night for some poor old guy whose free microvascular flap is dying because he smokes and drinks and sick. Anyway, all those things that are hard work, and cosmetic surgery, it was an out. And it's fairly lucrative, and I liked people to look nice, so it appealed to me. But over the line, you probably have noticed that over the past sort of decade, the cosmetic surgery, the expectations of the patients and the marketing has, to my way of thinking, got out of hand. I mean, it's a great thing. Some people benefit so much from having a cosmetic procedure done that improves their quality of life, which is what medicine's all about. But we're now getting this superficial where some young girl who looks perfectly attractive wants to have bigger breasts because her mate on Instagram's got bigger breasts, and they're just probably retired earlier than maybe I would have if I still did less stressful things on more reasonable people. So, yes, having something to do in retirement that not only to do but to make you feel relevant. One of the worst things that can happen to high-performing people in any world, particularly medicine, is that you get relevance deprivation syndrome. All of a sudden, bang, you're not Chris Edwards' high-powered plastic and reconstructive surgeon anymore, you're Chris Edwards' pensioner. It's sort of you lose that. So if your ego is very, very strong, I guess you can cope. But if you've got an ego that likes a little bit of admiration, then you need something else to make you feel like you've got some relevance. And I'm still part of the economy. I still pay taxes and fill out VAS statements, and as much as I complain about it, it does make me feel relevant.
Also, just because you mentioned it earlier, I was interested in how do you think plastic surgery has changed over the years?
Well, technologically, it's changed in that there have been a lot of advances in technically what we can do. When I was training at the very beginning, there weren't microvascular free tissue transfers at all. It was, you had to waltz things up on funny pedicles, and the whole system was different. So microvascular free tissue transfer came, it evolved as I evolved. Facial reconstructive plating systems. We used to wire people's faces up after major accidents with external frames and wires, internal wires. You'd drill holes and thread a wire and tweak it. On you'd go, and now, of course, you've got these highly sophisticated plates and screws, and now 3D scanning and 3D printing. You don't have to now go and carve out a bone graft from someone's skull and see if it'll fit. You now take an image and say, that's the deficit. You get a bit of titanium 3D printed and screw it in. Craniofacial surgery is advanced. Cosmetic surgery techniques have advanced dramatically as well. Facelift used to be sort of make an incision around in front of the ears and dissect down under the skin a bit until you didn't want to dissect anymore and put your foot on the back of the head and pull back as hard as you could. But now the techniques are very, very sophisticated as to what can be done. But the trouble is, in parallel with that has come a group of non-trained. Cosmetic surgery is very lucrative and it's not immediately high tech as far as life-threatening is concerned. So people have been doing minor surgeries, putting breast implants in sort of fairly average facilities, and they're attracted by the money. So we've got untrained people doing bodgy work, getting horrible results, and then we've got others. We've got a whole patient base that they've got unrealistic expectations and marketing that's got completely out of control. So that's sort of the dark side of the progress of plastic surgeries through the ages. But it's a very exciting field. The reconstructive side is a very exciting field. Cosmetic side is as well, but you have to be able to, you have to now be able to deal with personalities and the hype and everything that goes with it.
Have you had any patients come in with really unrealistic expectations or ridiculous requests?
Yes. Yeah, we all do. I used to say, probably still do, that cosmetic plastic surgeons are just operating psychiatrists. You do have to be fully aware, and that's why the benefits of some art and humanities to a medical practitioner is very beneficial, because you have to not only deal with the physical thing that you're seeing and the patient's seeing, but the psychology of the whole deal. Some people can't tolerate a big operation to achieve their results. Some people want a big operation to achieve their results. Some people got unrealistic expectations. Many people, you've probably heard of body dysmorphia, many people don't see their own bodies anywhere near like everyone else does. Their whole self-view of their body is different. It's like, my nose is sticking out so much, everyone's looking at me in the street, and they've got a perfectly normal nose. They're psychologically, they need a psychiatrist, they don't need a plastic surgeon. But in between those and the very reasonable individual who wants to look a bit more youthful because they work on television, they're easy. You give them a good result and they go back to work on television, fine. But you get someone who says, I need my breast made bigger because my husband says he doesn't like me anymore, you'll end up, she'll hate you and she'll hate the husband, and it'll be a three-way hate session because she didn't want the breasts, he didn't like her anyway, especially if something goes wrong. So, yes, you do have to really sift through people whose expectations are unrealistic and people who won't benefit from the surgery. They've got underlying psychological problems. Some people will bounce from one operation to another. They'll come and say, I want to have my nose done. So you don't need your nose done. I won't do your nose. Oh, well, what about doing my breasts? Well, what do you want done to your breasts? And, oh, I don't know. What do you think? Red flag. They're likely to be trouble because they've got underlying psychological issues. So, yes, there's a lot of that, a lot of that. And it's one of the that a lot of people get operated on that shouldn't be operated on, because, you know, the money is the driver in a lot of these cosmetic practices. So one of the bad sides of the of how it's progressed. You have to try not operate on mad people.
Going back to earlier, I really liked how you said that you don't really see yourself as someone who's retired, but more as someone who's transitioned, because I believe that learning is a lifelong thing and you don't really stop it. So is there anything you can think of that you would like to learn more about right now?
I'm more, I wouldn't say passionate, but I'm more driven to learn now than I was when I was at school. Learning at school was just something that adults wanted you to do. Now I enjoy learning. If I read a word, because being dyslexic, I haven't read anywhere near as much as most people my age, particularly educated people, would have read. So my English is not good. I didn't ever do proper English at school. I did a thing called English 1, which was for dodos who couldn't get through school, who needed to learn how to communicate in the outside world. I actually quite enjoyed it. So anyway, where I'm getting to is that now if I read an article in the newspaper and they use a word, or I'm reading a book and I don't know what the word is, but I just look it up on Google on my phone, I enjoy learning some of the new words. I enjoy learning some of the nuances of grammar in writing. I enjoy learning, and I find it frustrating now that the people that really need to value education are young people, because they're the ones who need to get educated, to get a skill, to get a good job, to keep the country going and keep themselves going. And if everyone was given the motive, well, you've got to give them the equal opportunity, but you've also got to give them motivation. And it's very hard to give someone whose parents don't value education motivation to get educated. But it's a long-winded way of answering your question. That I just enjoy learning stuff, anything. Disadvantages, I can't remember it anymore. So I learn it and then I can't remember it again. But I enjoy learning anything.
Well, that's really great to hear. One of our themes for this podcast is to try and gain a new perspective of something. So I was wondering if you could, from your experience in mixing and dabbling in both art and medicine, tell us a bit about any new perspective that you've gained from it.
One thing is that I've learned a lot of things from my art, as I alluded to before, about three-dimensional form, and it dramatically, I feel, improved my plastic surgery skills. The other thing that's happened is that by mixing with sporting people and art people in the arts world, it grounds you to a certain extent. I think medicine can become a little insular. In my day, because we did so much on call and so many weird hours and had so many traumatic experiences with people dying and getting sick and stuff, the only people that understand that are other medical practitioners. So for a while, I became fairly insular. I think a lot of doctors can remain insular. So the contact with other people in other worlds can be grounding and give you a new way of thinking about the world, but also taught me that doctors aren't the only clever people in the world. I now work with some artists who are very, very clever people, and it does bring you back a little bit. That I don't know about you guys now, but I did start to, because medicine was so hard to do and we had such long hours and we did such important life-saving stuff, started to feel like we were pretty good, like we're important people. And it is perhaps the case, yes, we are. You know, we take on a lot of responsibility that other people seem to get away with making lots of mistakes. You can't make that many mistakes in medicine. In other words, you've had dead people down the lying in the streets. But there are other clever people. That's one thing that I learned. And I also have learned there have been times when I just took what I did for granted and grizzled and grumbled about the fact that I had to go to work and do another 10-hour operating lists, and I hate doing local anaesthetic cases, they're boring. Whereas really, you know, people in the early stages, they would have given their right arm to be in my position to be able to be doing plastic surgery. My daughter, who's a general practitioner, said that all her friends said, oh, your father, who's a plastic surgeon, oh, I'm just trying to get into the plastic surgery scheme, and here am I trying to get out of the plastic surgery scheme and retire and become a sculptor. So I think you need to pinch yourself a lot and appreciate where you are, which I perhaps didn't do enough of, and also to perhaps learn that, as everyone's heard, you know, life is a marathon, not a sprint. And I went flat out at the beginning, thought the harder I worked, the more successful I was going to be, and there's a risk in burnout. I think I did burn out a bit by just working too hard. I think there's perhaps more lifelong benefit in working a little slower, having a little bit of time off frequently rather than working flat out and then going to Aspen and skiing flat out for 2 weeks, because it doesn't work that way. You wear yourself out at both ends. You get sick of skiing when you're skiing flat out. You feel you have to because you've paid for it and you work too hard. I think smelling the roses is important. And I think the empathy thing too, if actually seeing other people's point of view and understanding life from your patient's side is something that is very important for people in the medical profession to do. And I think something like getting involved with art and other people involved with art certainly helps with that.
Yeah, it gives you a broader perspective and helps you relate better to patients so they have someone who they can talk to and not just someone who would treat them as a case.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds good, and that is true. It's very hard to achieve, and we've all got our own personality. Some people can't relate. I've watched other colleagues of mine talking to patients, and they're using all these words that we understand. I understand them, but there's no way the patient's going to understand what he's talking about. He says, we've got to drill a hole in your occipital bone and go through here and blah, blah, blah. It's sort of like, well, slow down a bit. And this guy probably doesn't know what his occipital bone is. And just for example, but yes, learning how to deal with people and see how they see medicine from their side, not from your side, it all helps, and it keeps you out of trouble. I mean, I can now say, I suppose, without touching wood, that I didn't ever get sued. And I think if you invest your time in actually trying as hard as you can, it doesn't always work, to understand what it is the patient wants and getting them to understand how much of what they want you can produce, and trying to make them believe, which was the case with me, that you genuinely do have their best interests at heart. You're not you're not doing it because you want the money, or you're doing it because it's your hobby. So yeah, it's a fine balance, and everyone has their own difficulties. But I think having extracurricular activities speeds up the empathy.
I also think it was really important earlier when you were talking about how life is a marathon, not a sprint. I feel often as students, it can feel that we're studying for an exam and we'll say, it's okay, we'll get to our own life once we get past this exam, or once we finish this course, then our life will start and we can find what we like. But
the course is very long, and when we finish one thing, there's always something new we can learn or specialise in. And it's very easy to go from one thing to the next without remembering to take the time and actually enjoy ourselves. What advice would you give to students to find ways to enjoy their lives amongst the course they do?
I perhaps didn't do enough of it. I thought the degree was so hard that if I had a chance to have a holiday, I just needed to rest. But look, in retrospect, my mates who said, now we're going overseas to go skiing or we're doing something, and that they were making the very most of their lives. And there are, it's a balancing act, but there are definitely periods of your life where you do just have to say, I've got to give it my all for this brief period of time. But there are many stories about the people who say, when I've just passed these exams, things will be better. And when I've just got my practice established, things will be better. And when the children have just grown up a little bit more, things will be better. And when I've got a bigger house, things will be better. And before you know where you are, your whole life's gone by, and that was your life. So you do need to be cognizant of the fact that all of it is your life. And there are bits of it that lead you up the wrong path, but it's still your life, and you still lived it, and you gained experience. And is it Mark Twain who said, good judgment is gained from experience, and experience is gained from bad judgment. So that's, you need to make mistakes along the way, and whether that's shooting up the wrong road in your life's pursuit, but it's still part of your life, and you still got to just say that's all part of it, that for lived life, there's no one has an absolute dream run. There's, if they do have a dream run, it doesn't feel like a dream run, and they grizzle as much as the rest of us. So I think that Anna Wintour, a woman who runs Vogue, I think she said the same thing, is that you have to make mistakes in life, otherwise you're not going to become any good at anything, because you have to make mistakes. It's a little bit hard in medicine. I make mistakes in the workshop all the time. I'm forever messing things up and measuring incorrectly and having to fill in holes with welders and things. And it's been liberating to be able to make mistakes that don't really matter. I mean, I get upset if I ruin a bronze, but you get a lot more upset if you kill somebody or you get a bad result that's permanent. So you are, your creativity and your ability to experiment is more limited in surgery and medicine than it is in the arts, because you've got a lot to lose.
Yeah,
you treat all of it as life. I think back, and if I'd been efficient as a medical student, I could have probably just about done the whole course in a couple of months from the amount of study I actually did. I used to cram it all in at the last minute and then do really well at times. But you know, if I'd worked solidly, well, firstly, I would have had a much better grounding because if you cram, you forget it all again. But I could have fitted so much more decent social life in instead of carrying this millstone around my neck. If I've got to study, I've got to study, I've got to study. Why don't you actually do the study and get it out of the way and then you can enjoy life? But that was always my advice to my children is do your homework on Friday night. Don't leave it till Sunday night because all that does is ruin your whole weekend because you're worrying about doing it. Just get on and do it.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I definitely know that feeling of being weighed down by the knowledge that you have work you should be doing. Now, just before we finish,
because we are coming close to the end now, I just wanted to ask one last question. Do you have a mantra that you live your life by that you could share with us?
Well, one thing is to strive for and value quality. One of my things is quality. I'm a bit of a stickler for quality. I hate this new world of throw everything away. So value and strive for quality, and your reputation is your most valuable currency, much more important than money long term.
Yeah.
As for a quote, I mean, there are, you go to quote books, there are so many quotes, but there's one by an opera singer, I think it was, who said, "There are no shortcuts to any place worth going." And I think that's very, very true. Even if it looks like someone got there easily, if you go back through their history, you usually find they they've had to put in. There's a very good book that's worth reading if you ever get any time. It's Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
Yep.
He looks into why some people have excelled at something, like the Beatles or like Steve Jobs or all these people. And he just goes through the serendipitous things that happened in their lives and they happen to get handed the ball and they ran with it. A lot of us get handed the ball and we drop it again, but these people got a bit of a pass at the ball, they grabbed it, and it's in, an interesting book. Worth reading if you've got children too. It talks about education and, yeah, it's just fascinating. Why planes crash. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for giving up your afternoon to have this chat with us. For anyone listening, if you would like to see some of the sculptures, because unfortunately I know you had some really cool pictures, but we couldn't include them in the podcast. But where could we take a look at some of your sculptures?
Well, probably the best one is just to go to my website, which is the wcjedwards.com.au.
Yeah.
That will get to most of the, when I get around to adding some new things on there, but that's tells most of the story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been nice talking to you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the AMSA Ampule Podcast M2.0 series. Our code word for this week is TRAM, which if you go onto our website, www.m2020.com.au, and insert the code word in our portal, you go into running for some great prizes and giveaways. And over the course of our series, we'll be able to collect an image per week for our M20 sticker book. The M2.0 series is a subset of Ampule, the Australian Medical Students Association's ongoing podcast series to highlight speakers who would have presented at our 2020 AMSA National Convention. If you would like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website, www.m2020.com.au, or our parent website, www.amsa.org.au. Or if you prefer, we are on social media as AMSA National Convention on Facebook and Instagram. For more information of topics covered in this podcast, you can reach out to AMSA Special Interest Groups on Facebook, Instagram, and the AMSA website. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or the subsidiaries. If you would like to learn more about our public policies, please visit our website at www.amsa.org.au and select Advocacy followed by Official Policy. This episode of Ampule was hosted and edited by Angela Fotsu, with guests Christopher Edwards and music by James Polmier.